And are you still teaching up in Boston?
Oh, yes.
What is your schedule like?
I have a full load, but what I do, I concentrate all of my courses in one day. It's a very long day. Usually it's Mondays, but this time it was Wednesday, because most of the Jewish holidays were on Mondays. Mm-hmm. And it's good. I love it. I have marvelous students. And
what do you teach?
I always teach a course in the humanities, but never the same course. I never repeat a course. So I force myself to study before teaching. This year I was teaching, this semester, Parable and Paradox in Ancient and Modern Literature, which means we covered the Bible and the Greeks and the Latins and Shakespeare and so forth, and Kafka and Dostoevsky. It's an adventure. And I have some 50 students, and they are very good. They give me so much pleasure.
Sounds like you're teaching what you love.
Otherwise, why do it, really?
Yeah. You do an awful lot of traveling, don't you?
Occasionally. I try not to, but I must. Mainly to Paris, really, because I write in French. So I have to see my publishers. And then I'm doing a book together with President Mitterrand. Non-political dialogues, meaning we have a rule not to touch politics, only philosophy and metaphysics and so forth, literature. So we do that, and therefore I travel a lot to Paris and back.
Tell me a little more about how you're working this out with Mitterrand.
We meet, and it's very easy. You know, we talk, and it's recorded. And when around 10 topics, childhood, literature, power, death, these kind of things. And once the conversations are recorded, they'll be transcribed. I will see his text, he will see mine, and then we'll meet again. It's a long-term project, but I hope by next summer it's going to be true.
Who does the actual writing?
Both of us, meaning we're not writing yet, we're simply talking. But once we have the entire manuscript, we will exchange manuscripts, and both of us write. He writes, he's a very good writer.
He's very good. I remember reading a book, I believe it was called The Wheat and the Chaff. Mm-hmm. Remember that book?
I made that's it right. And it had in French it's called Le Voile Chen. That's right. He's a good writer. He has a marvelous taste for words.
William Styron did the introduction to that book, mm-hmm. as I recall.
Yeah,
it's a very good book. Yeah. Let's talk about your book. I want to talk about a number of things, but let's talk about The 6 Days of Destruction. This is quite an unusual book and quite an unusual approach to writing about the Holocaust. Tell me how this book came about.
Well, I have not written that much about the Holocaust, really. I have published by now some 30 books, but only 4 or 5 deal with the subject. I believe one cannot write about it, and yet one must write about it. One cannot speak about such a subject, and yet one must speak, one must bear witness. Hence the tension, the conflict, inherent in the very effort, in the very project. In this case, a suggestion was made by a group of rabbis of the UHAC, to have some kind of liturgy to commemorate that event. And a friend of mine, Albert Friedlander, was a rabbi too, and a good teacher, a good writer, and I decided to do it together. So he took care of liturgy, and I wrote simply 6 days. And the idea was really to counter the 6 days of creation. 6 days of creation, but then I feel creation ended. Creation was destroyed. Everything else was destroyed. And just as we have in the Bible the story of creation, I felt maybe we should also know the story of destruction.
Mm-hmm. Each of your stories, well, actually you have written 6 short stories.
Exactly, 6 short stories, right, for every day. But as in creation, in this case, of course, we are drawn deeper and deeper to the end. There, we are drawn to the beginning. In the beginning, that's the first word, the first expression in the Bible. But then the real beginning was with man and woman on the 6th day. In this case, it's the end of man, the end of humanity, the end of everything else.
Of course, the 6 days could also be viewed as a metaphor for the 6 million.
It's always 6. 6 is a very strong figure now. And it's part of Jewish history, part of Jewish mentality. We always 6 days of the week, then comes the 7th, but we are waiting for the 7th, which hasn't come. But since the war, it's true, whatever is suggested in 6 reminds us of the 6 million.
Tell me about the, of course, your stories are moving and very powerful, but the second portion of the book consists of the liturgies. How are these to be used?
They're really, I feel they are to be used according to the wish and the desire and the temperament of every congregation. That's the way the rabbi or whoever is in charge feels that day about that particular subject. The idea is to bring everyone else in the picture, meaning everybody participates. This is an event which touches every single human being, of course every single Jew, but every single non-Jew as well. And somehow we must feel that we are part of it. Now, one cannot be part of it unless one really lived it through or died it through. One cannot even say lived it through. But this is history, and this is memory. So we are giving memories to those who have no memories.
Of course, these liturgies can also be used in the Christian religion as well.
Yes, certainly. But I mean, Jews and non-Jews, of course, can and must come back to that period.
Have you encountered, on the part of the Christian world, a degree of guilt, a sense of guilt for what happened in Germany?
No doubt. It means those Christians who are profoundly sensitive to the tragedy, most of them feel guilty. Now, I don't think that they individually should feel guilty. I don't believe in collective guilt. Only the guilty is guilty. Only the killer is guilty. But they are so sensitive to their own past, which, of course, to their honor, makes them more open to all their own questions and interrogations and self-interrogations. I think Pope John the 23rd, he felt guilty.
Didn't they actually hold Christian religious services at the concentration camps while they were killing people?
Well, there were some Christians, of course, who occupied high positions in the killing squads. This is one of the amazing and disturbing and frightening aspects of the whole story, that there were persons who went to church in the morning, and almost straight from church they went to kill. And then they came back from the killing places and went to confession. But in all fairness, I don't like to speak about these issues because I would prefer Christians to do that. It's unfair. I'm a Jew, and I'm profoundly Jewish. And to criticize the church, unless I had no choice, and I had some problems with the Pope, so then I speak up with respect, but I try to say what I have in my heart. But usually I would prefer anyway Christians to do it, and they do it. There are very great Christian thinkers, theologians and writers who do that. François Mauriac in France, who was my patron in French literature, Robert McAfee Brown here, Cargas, Alice and Roy Eckhart. I could give you a long list of respected and great Christian thinkers who do precisely that. They speak about the part of Christianity in the Holocaust.
What about Germany? Can Germany ever end its guilt for what happened?
But again,
you traveled to Germany, haven't you?
I've been there twice, almost for a few hours, almost for a day or so. I don't think that a German youngster is guilty. I don't think a German per se is guilty, unless that German has done something. During the war, it was Germany. We cannot deny that. Why should we deny that? After the war, they made a distinction between Nazis and Germans. But in all honesty, during the war, when we spoke about the enemy was the German. We didn't say the Nazis are coming. We said the Germans are coming. But today, I feel it's unfair to say to a boy or girl born in 45, you are guilty. Why? They are not guilty. Children of killers are children, not killers. But because they come from such a background, and because they are sons and daughters of such a people with such a past, they are now responsible for that past, meaning not for the past itself, but for what is being done with that past. If they take their own memories, and it's not easy, I understand, to be the son of a killer is not easy. I've met a German young man who moved me to almost tears when he came to me and he said, look, I found out a few years ago that my father is an SS. Was an SS. and I left home right away. I haven't spoken to him since. What should I do? And the honesty, the sincerity, the pain in that young man moved me very deeply. So it's not easy, of course, to be the son of an assessment, of a former assessment.
What did you tell him?
Oh, I spoke to him, but can I cannot say anything except speak to him and tell him, first of all, that he surely is not guilty, and how to work it out, and how to speak to his father and listen at least, and see not to see to it that his life should not be destroyed, his own life. His father's life was destroyed, because his father had destroyed so many lives. But he, the son, should not destroy his life, and shouldn't allow anyone to destroy his life. So we had a long discussion, and a good one. So what I try to say is that the young Germans today have an extraordinary opportunity, privilege, and burden at the same time, to do something with the memories that they have inherited from their parents.
Well, it is difficult to ascribe collective guilt, no doubt, and yet sometimes Germany has had a history of being a militaristic nation, and you wonder if traditions are not sometimes passed down. I don't know what the tone is in Germany today. It seems to be a lot of division in that country from what I read. There was a book that came out in the early 1940s called Is Germany Curable? And it speculated that Germany would never be curable. I don't know if this is accurate or not, but what worries me is that there may not be a sensitivity among young Germans to what happened. I don't know that this sort of tragedy would ever happen again, but just being unmoved by it is in itself a tragedy.
It is. I think it was true probably until a few years ago, when nothing was said really about the tragedy in German textbooks. And so the elders tried to shield their children, the young people, from the shame of the past. I think now it's different. I have a student in my class who came from Germany. His name is Reinhold, one of the best students I ever had. Pure, innocent, committed. And you feel the pain in every fiber of his being. A young man, early 20s, wants to do his PhD on this subject. And there are young people like him. I am not ready to give up on the German youth. I would rather feel, but I'm not sure, that the youngsters in Germany today are more pacifists. They are inclined towards pacifism, not to militarism. They have seen where militarism leads. They have seen that it ends with murder. The murder of a continent, the murder of the image of man in history. And therefore, most youngsters in Germany, I would venture to say, are rather inclined towards pacifism.
Recently, in preparation for an interview I did with Dean Thomas, I read The White Hotel, and he had used as part of his source this wonderful book about called Babi Yar. I can't remember the author.
I remember his name.
I can't remember the author. I had read that book many years ago, and Thomas was deeply moved by it. And of course, The White Hotel is a metaphor for death. In reconstructing what happened at Babi Yar and reading this book, did you read The White Hotel,
yes,
the book?
Yes.
As you recall, the heroine of the book is not Jewish, but her son is half Jewish. And when her son is sent off, she decides to go with him, and she is murdered and raped by a bayonet at Babi Yar in a trench, in this terrible trench. And after I finished reading this book, the question that has always come up came up again, even bigger. Why? 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 It's a question I guess no one can answer, but perhaps someone like you can speculate. Why?
Oh, we don't know. I don't know, really. I don't think there is an answer. And if there is, it's a wrong answer. There cannot be. How can one explain? To explain is almost to justify, to comprehend the murder of 6 million people, 1 million children and more. One cannot understand. But the repercussions and the reverberations of these questions are many. When we arrived in those places, I remember my first astonishment was, what's the meaning of all that? It's not only why, because why, after all, we Jews have suffered for 2,000 years in so many places, under so many circumstances, under so many skies, for so many reasons. So I will suffer again. So I was not really asking myself why again us, and why in this way. It was just in the beginning, I just arrived. But as I was looking and watching, I said, what's the meaning of all that? I came into a place where to live was the exception and to die was the norm. And we saw the flames and everything went on. It went on as if it were a world, a normal world with its natural laws and principles. Killers killed, victims perished, and it was a society with its own rules, with its own theology, with its own language, with its own customs, with its own culture. And it worked. The system worked. The fire burned, the corpses were incinerated, the ashes were dispersed, and the sky was blue, and more people came, and more people died. And I felt, what is the meaning of all that? What does it mean? It must mean something. And to this day, 45 years later or so, I still don't understand. I'm asking myself this question every day. What is the meaning of all that? It must have a meaning. Everything else has a meaning. And I don't know what it means.
How old were you? You went to Buchenwald.
No, I came to Auschwitz. Birkenau, Auschwitz. I was 15 then.
15. When you were taken to Auschwitz, did you have any comprehension as a teenager about what was happening?
Oh, no, we didn't know. We Hungarian Jews were the last to be taken, really. We were 600,000 Jews in Hungary. And until March 44, we rather lived a relatively quiet life. We had a fascist regime, a fascist region called Horthy Miklós. And somehow, there was no problem, really. There were massacres 100 kilometers from our place, and we never knew. At one point in 1940 or 41, the fascist government expelled the so-called foreign Jews who couldn't prove their citizenship. And they were taken, I think, 50 or 60 miles across the border, because my city, my town was near the border of Poland. And one man came back, I describe it in my book, in my first and only memoir, and he used to be a Beatle. And he came back with terrible stories. He said he survived the massacre, he had seen the massacre. And nobody believed him. I didn't believe him, I liked him. He was a very, very good old teacher and friend to me. And I would listen to him night after night, thinking the man is crazy. And because I loved madmen all the time, I loved madmen, so I spoke to him a lot. And I listened to him even more, never believing him. I was convinced the man is fantasizing. And the problem really is that nobody in the entire world cared about us enough to warn us not to go. The Russian army, the Red Army, was 20 kilometers from my town. We were 3 months away from D-Day. Less. 3 weeks away at the end. And yet nobody told us, don't go. If anyone had told us, don't go, because there is something called Auschwitz, our city was surrounded by mountains. And we could have escaped without any problem. We had two Germans in town, and some 50 older, young gendarmes, nothing. There was no problem. We could have left the ghetto and gone into the mountains and hidden and waited for the Russians to come. But we didn't know. And when we arrived end of May to Auschwitz, and we saw the railway station with the name Auschwitz, we had no inkling of what it meant. No one had ever heard the name Auschwitz. And so we came there, and the whole world knew already. You know, you read here in the United States, the New York Times, you will see every single paper, beginning 42 and surely in 43, already knew what was happening. We in Hungary didn't know, because nobody told us. And to this day, I don't understand. If Roosevelt had gone on radio, on CBS, and said, Jews in Hungary, the enemy is cruel, the enemy plans to take you to Auschwitz, and Auschwitz is a death factory, we would have believed him. Nobody told us. So Hungarian Jewry was liquidated in 6 weeks. That was Eichmann's last crowning operation. They arrived March 17 to Hungary, they took over the regime, and it all went very fast. In 6 weeks, actually, there was a ghetto, and then the liquidation, the transports, and that was the end.
And yet, some survived.
By accident, really.
How? Why was it an
accident? I don't know. Oh, because I was the wrong person to survive. I was always weak. I was always always looking for doctors. And at home, I was... If anyone had told me I would survive, I wouldn't have believed it, because really I wasn't the type. I'm always intimidated, I'm frightened, I would never do anything out of place, I wouldn't offer myself to go anywhere, I wouldn't ask for a special portion of soup. I was too frightened.
I saw in the New York Times Sunday magazine a story about you some years ago before you won the Nobel Prize. And there's this dramatic photograph taken at Auschwitz.
No, from Buchenwald.
Were you transferred to Buchenwald?
Yes. In January, when the Russians came close to Auschwitz, we were all transferred to Buchenwald.
It was further from the
yes.
line?
They took. They managed to liquidate the camps and evacuate tens of thousands of victims, and most of them died on the way, and some reached other camps inside Germany.
You would have thought that the Germans would have had other things in mind, like fighting the Russians, but they kill right to the very end.
Oh, that was a priority. I think the killing of the Jews was to Hitler more important than to fight the Russians. The trains that took Jews to their death camps had a higher priority than the military trains going to the front. But all this is crazy. When you think about it, it's crazy.
Well, that photograph, Buchenwald, you were able to recognize yourself in the photograph?
Of course, yes. Because I remember the day when the photograph came. I remember my friends there. And, the features didn't really change much, except I was thin, emaciated. But I remember it well. It was the day of liberation when American officers came and took the photograph. Americans, yeah. Yes.
How did you find your way to France?
At the end of the war, when really the day we were liberated, I fell sick. My father had died already in January, so I fell sick. I fell sick because of a curious thing. The Americans came in, and they were heartbroken. I'll never forget a few American soldiers, a sergeant, a black sergeant, who was crying like a baby when he saw us. And they didn't know what to do with us. They kept on crying, so they gave us all their food, and they gave us their bacon and whatever they had. Now, for us, we hadn't eaten already for so long. It was the wrong thing to do, to give. Now, I come from a religious home, and I would never have eaten something which is not kosher. In camp, of course, I would have eaten anything. And I remember that day, I picked up a military can of something spam, and I put it to my lips. I didn't eat it, but that was enough for me to faint, and I fainted. I woke up in the hospital. I had some blood poisoning. I stayed there, and when I came out, I heard that the American authorities want us to go somewhere, leave Buchenwald, and I had nowhere to go, because I knew my father had died. I was there when he died. Had my mother and my young sister also, I was sure they died. My older sisters, I was looking through all kinds of lists, they weren't there. So I go back. And we were 400 children, really, in that particular situation. We had nowhere to go. We would have gone to Palestine, but the British didn't give us visas. So De Gaulle heard about us, and he offered us asylum in France, and we came to Paris, or to castle near Normandy.
Oh,
we came to a castle near an orphanage home near Normandy.
So in your late teens, were spent in an orphanage?
I spent a few years in orphanage homes, yes, going from one to the other, studying. I was a choir conductor, always to make ends meet, and giving lessons in Hebrew and the Bible to all kinds of children, and that's how I lived in France.
You studied at the Sorbonne.
I studied later at the Sorbonne, yes. And it was really something very moving. A year ago or so, I was in Paris, and the Sorbonne gave me an honorary degree. And when you heard the rector and the presidents praising you to seventh heaven, but all I could see in my mind was, as a student, I had every morning a very important problem to solve. Should I walk to the Sorbonne and eat a sandwich, or take the bus and not eat a sandwich? And I was out wondering, you know, they say now all kinds of nice things, but when I needed some help, nobody was there, even after the war. But, you know, you also learn the virtue of gratitude. It's a very strange phenomenon that no one really can experience the depth of such gratitude as we can.
You're talking about the French. I mean, gratitude toward the French.
Toward everybody, strangely enough, towards people. When we came out of the camps, instead of being angry at everyone for not having gone through the camps, I was happy for everyone for not having gone through the camps. I was thankful to everyone who remained human and who could sleep at night and who was not so hungry to become dehumanized. And we all felt that, really. And even today, for us, I mean, those who went through those experiences, the slightest gesture towards us fills us with gratitude. Because every moment is a moment of grace.
You became a journalist. You adopted French as your language. You became a journalist for an Israeli newspaper.
Oh, by accident. I first became a journalist for French newspapers. I wanted to go to Palestine. I didn't know how. Money I didn't have. And the only way for me to go then was to be a kind of war correspondent, so I had no idea what it meant. And I went to Israel in 1949, actually, to do a few articles for a French paper. And after a few months, I wanted to come back to Paris to study more. And I realized that the best thing for a journalist is to be a foreign correspondent, because we have no boss. And I looked for an Israeli paper. The only one that didn't have a correspondent was the poorest one. So they gave me a kind of letter appointing me as Paris correspondent, and I made, I think, $20 a month. Now it's the richest paper in Israel, but that's probably because I left it.
$20 a week?
A month.
A month. Well, I can tell you that journalist wages aren't much better today. But this was your first writing?
No, I began writing when I was very young. As a child, I wrote all the time, and it's not good. I found a manuscript in my hometown. I wrote commentaries on the Bible, which was fashionable then for Hasidic young men like myself to write commentaries. But I wrote and wrote and wrote a lot. I found, as I told you, and it's not good, of course. It's really, it's bad even. But I always felt the need to express myself in written form.
Night was your first book, the memoir, very moving book. You'll be remembered for that for many, many years. How did Night come about?
Well, in 1945, I knew that since I survived, which I didn't know I did, as Primo Levi was a very close friend of mine, the one who committed suicide 2 years ago, last year. And whenever we met, we spoke about it, that actually we have to look at each other to convince ourselves that we are alive. For years, there was some question both him and me. Maybe I'm not alive. It's only a dream. And that question was applied as much to him as to me. So, but after the war, I knew that since, after all, I am alive, I have to do something to deserve it, to be worthy of that survival. And I felt, as a Jew, so strongly about the need to bear witness, because the entire Jewish history really is, could be comprised in that expression, to bear witness. We are God's witnesses. But I also felt I wasn't equipped. I was not sure I could find the right words. So I decided already in 1945 to wait 10 years. And for 10 years I didn't speak about that event at all. I've never mentioned it to any of my friends or any of my acquaintances. Never. As a journalist, I went through the world. I traveled a lot. And never speaking about it. left. But then 10 years later, I wrote, and technically, François Mauriac, the Nobel laureate, and you know, French Christian writer, one of the best in the century, member of the Academy, an old man. He was instrumental in that. I came to see him about something else, about Mendes France, and he urged me. He said, look, the time has come, you must write about it. When I have written my book, when I had it completed, I brought it to him, really, because I had no contacts. And he, this old man, really, took my manuscript and brought it from publisher to publisher and so forth. I owe him quite a lot.
When the book was published, how did you feel? Did you feel that somehow it was a catharsis?
No, I don't believe that writing, in my case, serves any purpose of catharsis at all. Maybe the opposite. It deepened the pain, it made it more invisible, but it deepened it, and the scar became more burning. It wasn't it. Once I wrote it, and you know, the book, which has 120 pages or so, 140 pages, in the beginning had 860. I cut it from 860 to 120, 140. Because what is not said is as important as what is said in this kind of literature. But I didn't feel it as a world-shaking event. The book came out. It wasn't that easy to publish anyway. In America, for instance, you should know, although the book, thanks to Mauriac in France and in Europe, made an impact, here it was impossible to find a publisher. Georges Borchard, who was my friend and my agent and still is, literally took it to every publisher in America. And everybody said, oh no, it's too somber, it's too sad, and who wants to read about these things? Nobody wanted it. And finally he found a small publisher, Arthur Wank, marvelous man, he had the courage. So he gave us, I think, $100 in advance for royalties, and it was all right. I didn't need it. Not for money. One doesn't write for money.
That's what most authors in this country say today. I don't write for money. My books haven't made a dime. You have an interesting writing style in that you write in French, and your work is translated by your wife.
Yeah.
Have you ever... Are you doing any writing in English at all?
No. My English is not good enough, really, and I respect language so much. Why hurt it? Why wound it? My wife has a marvelous ear. She was born in Vienna, and she was during the war in all kinds of French internment camps. And we met afterwards, and since we married, really, she translates me, and she has a good ear for that. And her English is perfect. Mine is not. I can teach in English. I do, obviously. Occasionally, if she's not here, I have to write an article for some paper, and then I write it in English, which is then being corrected or edited. But my language is French.
How did you get to America?
Well, by accident, in every sense of the word. I came from the same newspaper for which I worked. By 1956, I already had a salary of $175 a month. And my editor-in-chief, his close friend named Dov Yudkovsky, said, look, go to America, you know, start learning the world. And I asked, can I live on that? He said, try.
Go. Good luck.
But I came to New York, and it so happened that a few weeks after I arrived, one evening as I came to the New York Times to buy the New York Times and read it in order to be able to report, to send my cable, my daily cable to my paper, I crossed 45th Street from Broadway, 7th Avenue, and the taxi cab hit me. And I woke up 10 days later in the hospital. So I spent almost a year, really, on crutches and wheelchairs and surgery one after the other. Strange destiny. I remember when I came to, I wanted to laugh, you know, to have gone through the war and die in an accident in New York. It's funny.
Yeah, what a irony to be hit by a taxi. So you recuperated. It took 3 years to recuperate.
It took me a year, first of all. I had the doctor who took care of me, really, is a man named Paul Bronstein. He was then the chief orthopedic surgeon at New York Hospital. It's he who put me together.
So by that time,
By that time,
stay yourself, might as well stay.
No, not so simple. No, I was actually here with a French travel document. I was not a French citizen, so I had a journalist visa for a year. And when I had to validate it, I went to the immigration. They said, "We shall do it as a journalist. You should be, of course. You should have a visa, but your document is only 1 year. For 1 year, you must go and validate it." I went to the consulate. They said, "You must go back to Paris." I said, "How can I go back to Paris? I'm in a wheelchair." And I went from immigration to consulate a few times. And finally, there was a man in the immigration who simply said, "Why don't you become an American citizen, for God's sake?" And I said, "How does one do that? I never thought of it." And he said, "I'll teach you how. I'll show you how." And since then, I have a soft spot for American bureaucrats. Really, he is the one who simply said, "Look, you have no passport, you have no citizenship of any country, become an American citizen," which I did with gratitude. And I 2 years ago, I remember, 86, when President Reagan gave us, we were 11 or 12 foreign-born citizens who got the Medal of Liberty and the Statue of Liberty for what he said, contributions to the American people. I felt very proud because I wanted to give back something to America.
That reminds me that I believe in 85, when you were chairman of the U.S. Holocaust Committee, there was a dramatic confrontation. I remember that in the White House. It was when Mr. Reagan said he was going to... what was it like when you in that room in the White House?
Well, it was a combination of many circumstances, because it all began with a congressional resolution offering me the Congressional Gold Medal, which is very rare and very, very great distinction. And by law, the president must give it. Congress is giving it for the American people, but he must physically give it to you. That's a medal in your likeness and so forth. And we wanted it, I think, in January or February. The White House has its own schedule. They said, "We'll do it on April 19th. All right. And the decision was made then that there will be an East Room, and I can invite my few of my friends, the president of his friends, 300 people. And then Bidberg was known. I tried to prevent Bidberg behind the scenes. I didn't want it to become an issue. So before even it was known, I tried to persuade some people in the White House to stop it and to change it. They didn't want it. And because they were afraid of what I might say, they moved the ceremony from a large East Room to a very small room of 30, capacity of 30, including the Secret Service men. And all I could bring, I think, was my wife, my son, and two friends, and that's it. But they didn't know that there would be live television and so forth. I'll tell you, I have a profound respect for the office of the presidency, and I like the president. I knew it wasn't his doing. He was urged by his advisors to go ahead. In order not to embarrass him, I sent him my speech a day beforehand. Nobody knows that. A day before the ceremony, I sent him my entire speech with a note, "This is my speech." And I met him an hour before the ceremony. And I said, "You read my speech. I hope it's not, and it's respectful and gentle and so forth." I felt I had to say it.
Were you scared?
No, why should I be scared? I'm scared.
In effect, you were challenging the president.
I was trying not to make it as a challenge, but really as a plea. As a plea from the Jew that I am, from the writer that I am, from the American Jew that I am, from the person that I am, a plea to the president not to do it. And if he had not done it, he would have been the hero of the world. I suggested to him that immediately after my speech, because the ceremony is there, he has to give me the medal. After my plea to him, I said, "Just imagine, you come back to the podium, and you said simply, 'All right, I am not going.'" I said, "The whole world would carry you on its shoulders. You will be the hero of the world, and people will say, 'Look, it's in character. He doesn't need advisors. He responds on the moment, and his feelings, his heart, his soul.'" But he had advisors there who were the wrong advisors. But you know, I must tell you, I believe in a strange sense of justice. I don't think that the good are rewarded always, but that the bad are punished, that I know. all the people who were involved in Bitburg, who gave the president that advice, are out of the White House.
Deservedly. The Nobel Prize, did you have any inkling? Did you know you were nominated, first of all?
Yes, I have been nominated both for literature and for the Peace Prize for a few years. And you know it because it's in the newspapers. Otherwise, you wouldn't know it. And you don't want to know it because it creates tension and expectations. And if you take it seriously, it's bad. If you don't, it's also bad. And therefore, it's better not to know. But from the newspapers here and there, people sent me in a clipping from here, you know, he nominated you, she nominated you, and so forth. So I knew that I was nominated, that's all. And all I knew that on Yom Kippur, the Day of Kippur, Day of Atonement, I was in the synagogue. And I came home during, because you have to fast the whole day. And I suffer from migraines, even without fasting. But especially on that day, I suffered terribly from migraines. So at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I came home to rest for, I live nearby the synagogue. And there was a journalist there in the lobby. And he introduced himself. He said, I'm from Norway, Dagbladet, an important paper, and I would like to see you. I said, sir, please, it's Yom Kippur. Come on. This is the holiest day in the year. I don't want to see a journalist today. He said, I must see you. I said, you cannot see me. Leave me alone. It's Yom Kippur. He said, it's very urgent and vital. I didn't want to make a scene in the lobby. I took him off. He said, look, he said, in my apartment, I want to tell you that in 2 hours we go to press, and the headline is that you get the Nobel Prize tomorrow. I said, please don't. Don't. I said, call. Here's a telephone. Go and call your editor. Tell him not to make a fool of himself. I have no idea about all that, and I don't think it's true. And I pleaded with him to call his editor, not to give the headline. He said, it's too late. We are going to press. I didn't believe him. So after I came back to synagogue and finished the prayers in the evening and went to friends to break the fast, I really didn't believe him. Until next day, they called from Oslo to say, you know, you won the Nobel Prize. And by then, it became a... a very, very busy life.
Oh, yeah. How has the Nobel changed your life?
Oh, it didn't change my life. Really,
not even a little? A little bit.
Superficially, really. Not more than that. If the war didn't change me, you think Nobel can change me? After all, I have measures, and the measures in my life is something else. All the honors in the world didn't change me now. If pain didn't, and tragedy didn't change me, why should this change me? I'm not saying that I'm not grateful. I am. It's a very great opportunity. And it's a great recognition, of course, the highest recognition in the world. It changed simply that, number one, I have more invitations. I could spend the next 10 years simply going from country to country on first class hotels and everywhere and be celebrated everywhere. I could simply, literally do that. Then it would be silly. For this, I should end my life like this, going around thinking and eating and seeing people. On the other hand, what is good, I could see that with this Nobel Prize, I got a key, and that key opens many doors. When I got the prize, I decided to go to Russia right away to see dissidents and refuseniks. And I saw that I could, I managed to bring out people from there, simply because I was a Nobel laureate. I began the campaign to bring back Sakharov from Gorky to Moscow, simply by saying I want to see him. Every 3 times a day I had a press conference in Moscow. They didn't dare touch me because Nobel laureate, you don't touch Nobel laureate. So I realized you can do certain things with that prize. And this is what I'm trying to do, but otherwise it didn't change. I go to my classes. I have never skipped a class nor missed a class. And I told my students, don't make a fuss about all that. I remain the same teacher that I was. And I write, and the same friends, not more nor less.
Well, I believe you described yourself a few minutes ago as a witness, one who is bearing witness. Certainly the prize has helped you to become a more powerful witness because you're able to spread the message, talk about these things, and people want to hear you.
But I don't even think they want to hear me. I am really not that serious about myself. I think they want to hear the Nobel laureate. That's the whole problem. It's not me. It's Mr. Nobel they want to hear truly.
Well, they wanted to hear from me before the Nobel.
Not the same way.
Enhancement.
Yes, but not the same way. One of the things I did, for instance, last January, I organized a conference together with François Mitterrand, because I saw what the Nobel can do. I said, if I could do that little, 10 of us could do more. And I convinced Mitterrand to have a conference in Paris, and we brought together 75 Nobel laureates. And I didn't have the money. I gave my money away. It's not enough.